Welcome to the Lacey School of Business Ethics Series, presented by Old National Bank. I'm Hillary Buttrick, Associate Professor of Business Law and Interim Dean at Butler University's Lacey School of Business. In today's podcast, we're having a conversation about issues of racial and social injustice in our community and beyond, and we're exploring ways that business and community leaders can make a difference. My guest today is Brian Payne, President and CEO of the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Brian, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
For those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Central Indiana Community Foundation, tell us about the mission, purpose, and work of your organization.
Well, we actually have changed our mission in the last couple of years. And we've probably changed the mission over 104 years. We're 104 years old, the Indianapolis Foundation. The Indianapolis Foundation, created in 1916, and was one of the first half a dozen or so community foundations created in the world. The very first one was Cleveland in 1914, and the banker network in the country started to follow what a banker in Cleveland did. And it was both a good bank business decision, since we're on a business broadcast. It made a lot of sense for business, for banks to do this. But there was also, right from the beginning, a very significant philanthropic community focus with creating a community foundation that would help the community. Our mission now is that we mobilize and leverage people, ideas, and investments toward creating a community where all individuals have an equitable opportunity to reach their full potential, no matter race, place, or identity. So that's our mission. It's really about creating a community where everyone has the opportunity to thrive. We know that, life isn't fair, but we hope that we want a community where social policy, public policy is fair and gives everyone a chance to thrive if they do the things that we always feel are necessary about success, having discipline, hard work, delaying gratification, all those things, getting an education, doing the right things. But, we've learned that, in America and in Indiana and in Indianapolis, systems have been based really favoring white people. To be honest, that's what it is. Systems have been created by white people to favor white people. And so there is not an equitable opportunity to thrive. And we want to create a community where there is. We do three things. We're a grant-making organization. We are a community leadership organization. And we are a donor services support organization. So we have, over 500 families or individuals or couples and some businesses, a couple dozen businesses, that have donor advised funds where our job is to help them make their philanthropy as rewarding and meaningful as it can be for them and as useful as it can be for the community.
I want to turn to one of the most pressing concerns in our community and our nation, a concern that has been brought into sharp focus by the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and far too many others, and that is the issue of racial injustice. You recently wrote on the CICF's website that we know our mission will take generations to achieve. Still, we believe that positive individual, organizational, systemic actions every day can make a difference in people's lives and make Indianapolis a place where there is more hope, opportunity, equity, justice, achievement, and prosperity. What are some of the programs that CICF supports to help make this vision a reality?
Well, we kind of talk about how we fight this, we're fighting this war on systemic racism, and our goal is to dismantle it. And dismantling is a very purposeful word for us. I wish we could say we could demolish it, right? We could take a sledgehammer and demolish these systems based on racism. We know that's not realistic. So dismantling means picking apart. And so we're looking to pick apart these systems. Some systems we think can actually be disrupted and replaced by a new system based on equity. Others are going to have to be reformed over time. Actually, I think reforming a system is way more daunting than disrupting, because if you disrupt it enough, you can kind of start anew. You know, and that's the conversation about police right now. You know, is it a reform hasn't worked? People have tried to reform police departments across the country to be more equitable, to be more of service to Black and brown communities. And that reform pretty much now everyone recognizes has failed pretty miserably throughout the country. You know, so now people are giving up on reform and they're looking at some level of, you know, of dismantling. And I know we're not here to talk about, you know, defunding the police. Is that defunding, I think, was the worst brand, you know, as you get your marketing students on that one. You know, that has not been a brand helpful idea because it's gotten people who, it's just put people's hair on fire, you know, and doesn't really enable a lot of people to have a meaningful, thoughtful conversation about what could be better about our police systems and more equitable. So, but we see about, we're fighting this war on two fronts at CICF. That's the way we think about it. One front is we want to create a movement, Hillary, of 10,000 people in central Indiana that will commit to becoming anti-racist and commit to kind of create a practice where they will always work on being an anti-racist and they will always work at some level on creating acts of equity. And so let me give you the math on that. So, you know, over next five years, can we get 10,000 people? And we're looking at creating an online portal framework where people will kind of sign up and pledge to be one of the movement of 10,000. And, you know, if they would do two acts of equity every week, 10,000 people doing two a week, 50 weeks a year, we'll give them 2 weeks off for vacation. And that would be 100 acts of equity times 10,000 people. That'd be 1 million thoughtful acts of equity in central Indiana every year. We think that is a game changer. We think that creates an environment where way more people can thrive and that we have a more equitable community. We have a more prosperous community and that lifts everybody up. That lifts everybody up. Everyone wins. An act of equity could be as simple as, you know, when I get takeout tonight, I'm going to make sure I do it at a Black or brown owned restaurant. When I make my contribution, I'm going to make a contribution of $200 or $500 or $2,000 or $20,000. I'm going to make sure that a good share, a really equitable share, maybe more than an equitable share for a while to try to get to parity, goes to organizations that are Black or brown led with significant Black and brown board members and serving Black and brown people. It could be that, you know what, as I help my own kid get a summer internship, I'm gonna reach out and help a Black or brown kid that I don't know. I have to do some work to find out who they are, and that's where CICF could be helpful. And I'm gonna help that person, that kid, use my network to get a summer internship. Those are all acts of equity, and we think that could be incredibly powerful. The second front that we're fighting is we are really trying to dismantle racist systems and replace them with systems built on principles of equity. And, you know, and we're looking at homelessness, you know, transportation and connectivity, work-ready pathways, scholarships, entrepreneurship, neighborhood resilience and relief. We've got this incredible ambassadors program that's teaching us what neighbors want, giving power to the neighbors. And we also are looking at criminal justice and significantly at criminal justice as well. That's probably the most racist system we have in America. But we've learned, you know, I'm a 61-year-old white guy, you know, I've been doing the work for the last 3 or 4 years and with a lot of help, a lot of mentors. And we have learned that pretty much every system in America is based really on racist principles. And we're looking to dismantle those, but we're working on about 15 projects over 5 initiatives.
I think there are a lot of people out there who are looking for a way to be an anti-racist. Perhaps they participated in the protests and now they're looking for additional ways to make an impact. How would you encourage or advise people to get involved?
So we get this question all the time, right? It's a question I'm sure I had. I have to remember that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, I was a well-intentioned, caring, clueless white person when it came to race and racism. And so I've done a ton of work. I mean, it's pretty much Every week every week I'm listening to multiple podcasts. I'm in the middle of reading books. People send me articles. I mean, there is so much information now. Maybe not the case 5 years ago. There was information, but maybe it wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't flooding the market, and now it is, right? And so, I'm now picking up my copy of White Fragility. And so there's so many books out there. This is a great book because it shows how it helps white people figure out how to talk about race, how to engage in the conversation, and what all the pitfalls are that we've been socialized, we've been socialized not to talk about race. We've been socialized not to know how, and actually not to have any resilience or any strength in doing it. That's why it's called white fragility. We're so fragile as white people in talking about race. And if God forbid someone would say, that offended me, that comment you made, and we just go into a cocoon and often pledge never to talk about race again because someone called us a racist. And what I've pretty much learned is we've all been socialized, white people have all been socialized to have racist perspectives. That's the way it is growing up in America. And it's not just America, by the way. That's why you've seen the George Floyd and the protests for social justice happening, in Paris and London, all over the world, because they have their own issues too. We have a unique, our own unique brand of racism, and it differs from state to state, from the South to the Midwest to the East Coast. A lot of people think Boston is one of the most racist cities in America. I've read that from lots of people over the years. So it's not just the South. They have their own unique brand of racism. We have our own unique brand. Every white person should read White Fragility, because you're going to fall into traps that are going to help you, that are going to keep your journey from being productive, and White Fragility will help you overcome those traps. There's so many books out. I'm just starting to read How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. It's a national bestseller. He won the National Book Award for his first book called Stamped from the Beginning, which was kind of the history of racism and race and the white race. In fact, I was listening to a podcast this weekend, the On Being podcast with Krista Tippett, an amazingly good podcast series. And she had Robin DiAngelo, the author of White Fragility, and asked, what could people do? And Robin DiAngelo she's pretty street talker. And she says, I'm amazed by, it's like, have you ever heard of Google? This is her answer. Have you ever heard of Google? How can you not know what to do? At this moment in time, how can you not know that you should go read a book? One of the 100 books, many of them are sold out. So you got to get them on Books on Tape because they're all selling out. Or a podcast or articles. You could scan The Atlantic, New York Times, New Yorker, anything, Indianapolis Star, and find articles. There was just an article about, Carmel, Indiana's challenge with racism and its perception of being a racist community. That was in the Star. I read that in the last couple of days. So start reading, start getting informed. That's the first thing.
So as you reflect on the role of education in combating injustice in our community and beyond, right? As adults, we have an obligation to continue reading, to listen to podcasts, to educate ourselves. How do you see the role of sort of formal education from our elementary schools through our universities in combating racial injustice?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my experience, and I've had this conversation with dozens, maybe hundreds of people in the last 3 or 4 years, and Black people too, is none of us learned about the history of racism in our schools. I mean, I had American history in high school. I had American history at UCLA. I half joke, but I'm half serious about writing UCLA and asking for a partial refund for my undergraduate degree because they didn't teach me anything in my American history class about racism. And, and so I've had to learn it, in my 50s. I thought that's what I went to school for, to learn a real story about American history. So I get pretty fired up about the lack of the fact that our schools have not really taught us, everyone quotes the great musical Hamilton, but it's the idea that the winners get to tell the story, get to make the history. Who gets to tell the story? And so we've decided, you know, that we are telling a story in American education and, in American history. You know, we tell the story from the most, generally the most flattering perspective. You know, the founding fathers were all geniuses, and they were great. They were great people. They had great intellect. They had great judgment in some areas, and they had great weaknesses, and we don't really learn that part of it. You know, I think we'd be a much stronger country if we knew better are both our strengths, our amazing superpowers of a country, and our amazing blind spots. I just read a letter, an open letter from Justin Holliday, who is a Pacers player. He wrote a beautiful letter, and he says, every time as a Black athlete that we speak out and criticize America, even if we preface it that we love America, we're told to shut up and cash in your $1 million checks, And it's like, why doesn't America want to take the criticism and get better, right? I mean, as a player, he says, my coach, when I'm not doing well or I'm not bringing it, my coach gives me criticism so I can take that. I look at films, I look at tape, I try to get better. Why isn't America willing to look at its weaknesses and get better? I thought that was very profound from Justin Holliday of the Pacers. So, gosh, right? I mean, we need to teach American history from a lot of different views. And, the 1619 Project that came out of the New York Times and Nicole Hannah-Jones is an amazing, re-looking at history from the first person enslaved in 1619. And she makes a great case that if you look at America from the Black perspective from 1619, that you will really understand America in a whole, in a more profound way. So it should be taught. It should be taught in elementary school. It should be taught in middle school. It should be taught in American history. It should be taught in Indiana history, which I guess is fourth grade, right? I grew up in California, but I know that. And then when you get to college, I would think if I was the czar of the world right now, to get an undergraduate degree from an accredited college in the United States of America, you'd have to have a class on the history of a history of racism in America. I don't care what you're studying. You don't get to graduate my university unless you take that class.
We are, of course, a business school. So in addition to reflecting on the role of education, what are your thoughts on the role that business can play in advancing the national conversation we're having right now on issues of racial equity?
I think it's huge. First of all, one of the things that I've learned in my career is to understand, like, if you want to do something in this community, your chances of getting something done will be to understand the community themes, right? And sometimes the themes change, right? Right now, many white person are becoming aware because the theme of the day has changed with all these murders of unarmed Black people. George Floyd being the most prominent, of course, the most shocking video. But of course, as you mentioned, Breonna Taylor, and we could go on and on and on, right? And so there's a theme going on now. But one thing about also understanding the DNA of a system is really important. And America, the DNA of America is business, right? We are the most, we are the strongest capitalistic society in the world. We are the one who believes in capitalism. Yeah, in fact, I'm listening to another great podcast series that comes out of Scene on Radio. Hillary, you and I, we got to know each other working on Seeing White that came out of the Scene on Radio. There's a season four that's called The Land That Never Has Been Yet. It's another remarkable 12-part series that looks at America from is it really democratic? When has it been strongly democratic aware? Where is it not democratic? Why is it not democratic? And one of the themes that comes out of that podcast is that a certain amount of democracy might be good for business, but another level of democracy is bad for business. And pretty much in America, what's good for business and capitalism overcomes what is good for democracy. Capitalism overwhelms democracy. When they're in conflict, capitalism wins in the history of America. That's what this podcast, I would say, is about. And maybe, you know, and I'm certainly not ready to believe everything I hear on that podcast, but I think that theme is a pretty strong theme that we all should consider. So businesses are hugely powerful in America. And if we want to change systemic racism, we have to do it with business. And, you know, that's the DNA of Indianapolis, by the way. The DNA is business and government try to decide together. And we've been, you know, have this great public private partnership that we celebrate in our mythology of Indianapolis. I actually think it's largely true in that case. And now it's philanthropy and not-for-profits that play a huge role. We actually, I would say, most of the big ideas coming about community improvement are coming out of not-for-profits, but nothing gets done unless business jumps on the bandwagon, because our DNA is business decides. So even as things have changed and there's not as many CEOs that are working on community betterment and civic engagement as there used to be 20 years ago, we still feel like if business doesn't get involved, we can't do it, even though the money's coming from philanthropy and the ideas are coming from not-for-profits to a much different degree. We still have business in our DNA, and that's America. So, you know, so business people, right? You get an MBA, you should have, you know, you should have real work done on the history of racism. You know, I just read an article, I think it was out of the Wall Street Journal, where they interviewed, you know, a dozen top Black business executives, and they all talked about how they all have common experiences about being held back and put down, or even if they're making it, like if they are straight A students in Harvard, and they know, people know they went from Harvard, they assume that they got to Harvard on some kind of affirmative action. So even you could be a straight A genius Black person at Harvard, and your white colleagues in business, and it's not just business, but we're talking about business, your white colleagues will probably think, yeah, well, you went to Harvard, but you got there on some kind of affirmative action. It's like, no, I had a 1600 SAT and got a 4.0. But, you know, if you start telling people that to defend yourself, then you're the angry Black man. So we got to, you know, business has, you know, all parts of society have a huge amount of work to do. But since business is so powerful, it's even more important that business leaders do the work.
Our podcast focuses on ethical leadership in a variety of contexts. Today, we're talking about leadership in the context of social justice. What can leaders do to ensure that their organizations are inclusive and offer a place of belonging for all people, regardless of background?
I'm going to quote from my, so I have the best thing, you know, I made a lot of good moves in my 35-year not-for-profit career, and I've made a lot of stupid moves. And among the best moves of my career was hiring Pamela Ross as my vice president of opportunity, equity, and inclusion, and hiring Tamara Winfrey Harris and then promoting her to vice president of community leadership and effective philanthropy. Tamara oversees, with me in partnership, all of our community leadership initiatives, and she's responsible for all of our donor services, and she's responsible for our grant making, at least the art of the grant making, not the financial execution, but the art of the grant making. And I have two brilliant Black women that are my colleagues now, and that's changed CICF, it's changed me, and it's changing our community. Pamela, we were proud to be given a top leadership award from the Black Expo organization and Indiana Black Expo. And Pamela accepted the award, and they asked her to speak about our work. And this comes from that. And now we've put this into kind of a more formal document. So this is Pam kind of challenging, all institutions. If you are an all-white institution, but say you believe in equity and inclusion, that needs to change. If you are a white-led institution, you have no leaders of color, but you say you believe in equity and inclusion, that needs to change. If you are an institution that predominantly serves people of color, but your staff and board does not represent the ratio of the people you serve, that needs to change. If you believe people are unfairly held back due to racist systems that still exist, be an advocate. If you don't believe people are still unfairly held back due to racist systems, get informed, because you're uninformed if you don't believe that people are held back because of racist systems. So there's more, but so what can people do? You know, we're looking right now, both locally, and we're leading this conversation. CICF is leading this conversation among a group of 25 community foundations nationally about how do we measure progress on people of color having real power in our country, in our, first of all, in our communities, and then our country. Because it's, you know, the United States is, you know, it's about power. Ultimately, it's about power. I mean, money means power. But power, you know, it's like, who gets to make the rules? The people with the power. And so, you know, you look at any sector, you know, but Fortune 500, I mean, you know, since we're talking about business, let's use that example. But I have it, but it's not just business, it's every sector. It's my sector, philanthropy. You know, my sector, we're making some good steps right now in the sector of philanthropy, but we are mostly white in the world of philanthropy. And there's this book called Decolonizing Wealth, which every business person should read, but it's really about foundations. And it's about how we've really created this colonizing environment and culture in philanthropy. So we have a lot of work to do at CICF. We will have to be doing our practice of it being anti-racist as an organization forever. But business, how many CEOs that are black or brown in the Fortune 500? You know, it's usually like two or three. It's usually two or three out of 500, you know, and yet 11% of America is black. So that's way underrepresented. So business, what does business need to do? They need to, you know, create the pipeline, get serious, give equitable opportunity, equitable training, equitable, access to black and brown people, BIPOC, you know, black, indigenous, people of color, you know, indigenous, Native Americans as well. And, if you're a company that doesn't have any black or brown or indigenous people on your board of directors, you got to do something about that. You don't have any black or brown or indigenous people in your C-suite. You need to do something about that, because you cannot be an equitable organization and be all white. It just can't happen. You don't have the perspective.
Brian, 2020 has been a remarkable year. We're in the midst of a pandemic. There's great economic uncertainty. And we're currently engaged in an expansive national conversation regarding racial injustice. This is an extraordinary time to find yourself in a leadership position. What have you learned about yourself as a leader during the first half of 2020?
Well, we've had to adapt quicker than ever. I mean, I've always been someone who understands the power of adaptability and flexibility. I've always believed in that, but we've been tested at new levels of adaptability. I think, you know, we're proud of how fast we've created, we've created a lot of relief funds. We created a lot of COVID relief funds. We were creating a lot of special racial equity funds. We've moved faster as a not-for-profit and a foundation than we've ever moved. So I've learned that I've learned how to move faster. You had to, or become irrelevant. So I've learned how to be quicker, faster in creating institutional organizational change. I'm exhausted, but then I look at universities, and running a university seems so much crazier and challenging than running a community foundation. So I have great empathy for other people's exhaustion as well, that many of whom have way more challenges than we do. But we have a lot of challenges to do the right thing and to do it well. I would say that personally also that I've always kind of known this. I'm someone who still, after 35 years in the business of running not-for-profits, I'm still kind of an adrenaline junkie. I do my best work when there's either urgency or crisis or opportunity that you've got to really seize an opportunity. You got to do it now. You got to do it quick, or you're going to lose it. That's when I'm at my best. So I'm actually kind of charged up about this moment in time. So I'm exhausted but exhilarated. I'm motivated. I've never been more motivated. That's a personally my style. is not a mismatch for this moment, you know, and so I feel grateful for that.
What would be your hope for the second half of 2020?
Oh my God. I don't know. We all joke about just this year, 2020. I mean, maybe we should, you know, if you're in the numerology, and I'm not really, but I have friends who are. So we should have been aware, right? 2020. I mean, it was just way too dramatic to not be aware that stuff was going to happen. I want this moment, this window of opportunity around racial equity and people becoming informed, I don't want it to close, right? I'm worried about that. I'm worried about, you know, especially if another crisis hits, right? Or, you know, we went from everyone talking about COVID to everyone talking about racial equity, and now COVID is growing again throughout this country. And so I'm a little worried that, well, we're going to go back to COVID as the crisis of the day and forget about the opportunity and the window of opportunity for racial equity. Also, I think, you know, human beings, you know, we don't have the greatest attention spans, and it's worse in 2020 than it was in 1920. And so are we going to just get tired of talking about racial equity and say, okay, we talked about it, I read a book, let's move on, people, quit boring me with this. I'm worried about that. So I don't want that. I want the racial equity conversation to stay as a priority and give people a chance or the incentive to get really informed, to do the work, to make a practice out of becoming an anti-racist, to make a practice out of creating a more equitable community. I actually, you know, one thing about Indianapolis that I've always loved, we work well together in across sectors. And I always take that as an opportunity that we can become the best at something, because everything depends on cross sectors, on cross-sector cooperation, collaboration, ideation. So I want Indianapolis and Central Indiana, or Indianapolis, I'll start with Indianapolis, to be the best city in America at creating an equitable opportunity for its residents to thrive. And that's my goal. I want to be the best in the country at doing that. And I think we have a lot of strengths to do that. We have some challenges, but I want that window of opportunity to stay open.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time, and we wish all the best to you and your colleagues at the Central Indiana Community Foundation.
Hillary, thanks. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be with you. I love Butler University. I get to interact with Butler all the time, and I'm a huge fan. So thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Lacey School of Business Ethics Series, made possible through the generous support of Old National Bank. This podcast has been a production of Butler University's Lacey School of Business. A very special thank you to Bram Shuckles and Kelly Schmidt of the Butler Arts and Events Center for their production assistance. Thanks for listening.